Good evening, everyone. Well, let's go ahead and start with a word of prayer. We just thank you, Father. We thank you for this opportunity to open up your word and to gain insights into your truth, your absolute truth. Just pray that you would bless the derby going on downstairs, that we'd be a good testimony in that context as well, and that this would just be an edifying time. Be with the youth group. May the word penetrate hearts there as well. In Christ's name, praise, amen. Excuse me. Okay, well, we are seeing here, this is in the midst of the rebellion of Absalom, and suddenly the author is presenting to us a series of individuals that cross paths with David here. Some are principled, those are the ones who are loyal, and then there are the problematic, namely Ziba. He's kind of questionable as we go on to see later, as far as, we don't know what to make of this guy, if he's really loyal or not, or is he just an opportunist? And then we also have the perverse, and we're going to see Ahithophel tonight, and Ahithophel was David's best friend, most trusted advisor, and he ends up turning on David, and he has written about this in a couple of Psalms. He refers to this treachery on the part of Ahithophel, and so we'll be looking at that as well. But before we get into that, and this kind of goes back to a question that was asked a few weeks back, and I made a point concerning, the significance of these 200 people that Absalom invited from Jerusalem. And I wanted to maybe kind of put that number in context a little bit here tonight. We're talking again about Jerusalem. And whenever we throw up a map, how big is that? You all live in the Omaha metro area, so you kind of have an idea of how big it is. But that's just a bunch of lines on a screen, right? And when you think about Jerusalem, the city of David, the original city that he occupied, how large was it compared to Omaha, the metro area?
I would say 480.
480? Okay. Yeah, the little 480 right there in the middle. Anyone else?
Boys Town?
Okay. Maybe Lake Manawa? Okay. How many people do you think lived in Jerusalem in David's day? Take a stab. 500,000. Okay. Hey, you were a brave soul. We're not going to condemn you for that. Okay, 500,000. Anyone else? 25,000? You think 25,000? Okay. All right, just keep those numbers in mind. This little area right here is the city of David. All this is just various facets of the city out developed over time. This is this greatest extent, as you can see right there. But this is its dimensions. You can see these bars up here. This is 2/10 of a mile. So, for instance, this is 1/10 of a mile. That's 2/10 of a mile. So how big is that area right there? Yeah, the word big does not apply. We've got something that is less than 1/10 of a mile. It's about 0.08 tenths of a mile wide, okay, by 2.6 or 0.26 miles long, okay. If you were to put that on the south side of Council Bluffs, here's Southview Bible Church. That's the property, okay, not just the building, but the actual, property boundaries. If you were to put this next to Southview Bible Church, that's how big it would be. That's the city of David, right? The great king. Not exactly by the world standards, is it? When you look at his capital, the city of David, which he occupied, and his palace was on this end right here. But when you look at that, you're looking at about 14 square blocks. In our context, that's 124 residences. I count them up on Google Maps. One elementary school, one religious organization, which will remain nameless, and a park, okay? Now, at four people, and that's a very generous estimation because most of the houses on South End here are occupied just by two people, older crowd, so no kids in the house. But let's say that they're all occupied by four people per resident. You're only talking a little under 500 people, okay? By today's standards, right, how we put our cities together. What, Midwest? Very spread out, okay? Let's see, what do I got here? If you were to be heading home tonight, and here you are on 23rd Avenue. There's Casey's. You can kind of make it out there. There's Casey's. By the time you drive under the interstate right here, you have driven the length of the city of David. So as you're turning that and you look and see the bridges in front of you, that's from one end to the other of the city of David, Zion. This is kind of a reconstruction of it. You can kind of get an idea of what it might have looked like. Of course, the palace was up here at the summit of the city. Here's Mount Moriah, even higher still. And this is the original city, though. This region right here, you have the Kidron right here. That's where David is crossing in our last previous passage. And it's interesting because what is called the old city today, if you were to go and see Jerusalem today and what they call the old city, doesn't even include the city of David at this time. What qualifies as the old city. If you get a look at it from the sky, here's the city of David. These are the old city walls. And these were actually built in 1537 by the Ottoman Sultan Suleiman the Great. So that doesn't even, you go there, you can go and see a little archaeological dig. You can watch videos on this if you want to, if you look on YouTube. But there's a little archaeological dig where they used to be a parking lot for the Wailing Wall, and they decided to dig it up, and sure enough, they found the city of David underneath of it. But it's buried, and it's no longer really part of what is called the old city Jerusalem. If you were to look at it from an aerial map, that's this region right here, okay? Cluster of, you know, houses built in the last century, and of course just a few archaeological sites. So how many people do you think could lived in Jerusalem at the time of David?
None of the above.
None of the above. Yeah, these are like gross overestimates. This is Nineveh, and so I thought, you know, well, what's population density here? And I was actually finding it hard to find some sources on the population density of Jerusalem. After I did all this stuff, then I did find one, or two actually, and they estimated the population. I came in pretty close, so I was happy about that. But it's interesting, we do have a number in Nineveh, concerning Nineveh, found in Jonah 4:11, that 120,000 persons who do not know the difference between their right and left hand, most likely referring to infants, small children, okay? So in the city of Nineveh, this is about 5 square miles. And here's Zion. There's the city of David. I mean, even by ancient standards, okay, this is a very small city. They estimate that there was approximately 600,000 people in Nineveh at the time that Jonah preached, okay? 600,000 people. So that does rank amongst the numbers that we were looking at there. So it's not impossible to think that that many people could have lived in an ancient city. And yet, that's not what the city of David was. But again, they estimate 600,000 total people. It was approximately 5 square miles. And so that leaves us with a population density of 120,000 per square mile. Now, when we apply those to Jerusalem, Jerusalem is only 0.02 square miles. Okay, again, it only fit within... Here, this is the armory of Esarhaddon. So a little fortress there that they had within the city. It could have fit well within inside that little citadel. And then, let's see here. Let's apply that number. And when you do, you come up with an estimated total population of about 2,500 people. 2,500 people. When you think about 14 square blocks here on the south end, 2,500 people, that's a lot of people to pack into that little area. That's an extra 2,000 people more than we're doing right now, okay, in our context. So when you figure in the 200 people that he invited, that's a significant number of people, is it not? You're looking at, you know, if you just count the adults here, 16% of the adult population. If you just count the males, you're talking 32%, a third of the adult male population would have been invited to this feast. And most likely it was the males, not the females that were invited. Oh, let's see here. So again, yeah, I just wanted to illustrate there. Same area. You know, I don't know, how many seats are there in this auditorium?
A couple hundred?
200. About 200? Okay. So you can get a lot of people in a small space, but we're talking about living quarters. So they got to have a place to eat and cook and do all the things necessary to life. As you think about ancient cities and the way they come up with these, I did find a couple of estimates, and the estimate said 2,000 people. Okay, 2,000 people in the city of Jerusalem. And obviously, the cities were built very different than ours. The way they come up with that number, by the way, is there are actually people who recorded the populations of cities, you know, in the 1800s in the Middle East, and things pretty much hadn't changed, you know, since ancient times in a lot of these cities, and that's how they figured the population density. You know, obviously, streets weren't exactly what they were in our modern times either. So how many people actually were in there? You know, somewhere around 2,500, most likely. Not a very big area. Any questions or thoughts there? Kind of puts that 200 in context, and that's what I wanted to do here tonight. Yeah, they would have been single or perhaps two-story homes. They didn't really reach above that. You know, they just didn't have the engineering, you know, abilities, that skills that we had today to build high rises, five stories tall. Anyone else? Okay. Yes.
How much more did the city expand
under Solomon? Under Solomon, it. Can you take me back to that original map, the one that shows the whole thing? A little bigger. The flat map there. Let's see. That one. It expanded to include this section. It's called, it's like the midsection here, the Ophel, and then the Temple Mount, what we call the Temple Mount today. That's what it was expanded to include. This portion right here was actually added under Hezekiah. And under Hezekiah, I think the estimate was that the city grew to about 35,000. So that once that addition was made, there was about 35,000 in the city. So. Yes. Yeah, that's right. And then I think this was built by Josephus, this, you know, this larger portion of the wall. So that would have been after Christ, that those walls would have been built and added in there. I can't remember what this was right here, but that was added in there some point too. Anyway, the key to the map explains all those details. All right. Anyone else? Yes, Joy.
Is that all walled in?
Yes, these are walls. Yeah, at different points. You know, it wasn't done all at once, but yes, they would have been the walled city portion. Would have been villages, you know, a little outside. You know, each city had its kind of villages that were its satellites and were plugged into that local city. Anyone else? Okay. Well, can you get me up to the timeline? Thank you. And what we're looking at now, again, David is approximately 61. Okay, Absalom is approximately 31. And Absalom at this point has spent 4 years grooming the nation for this grand moment. That grand moment is now unfolding. His plan is coming together rapidly. David has to flee on foot quickly. Even though he has done all these things and it's, you know, it's amazing how he pulled these things off. We know that this was also the divine plan. We are looking at God's discipline of David. Okay. And we're in the shadow of the Davidic covenant where God says, yes, I will discipline David, but I will not remove my loving kindness from him. I will not take my promise away from him. His line will reign. And so even David could not undo this with his own sin, okay? He was going to be disciplined, but he was not going to undo the fact that he was king. And then also we see in the rebellion of Absalom that the people could not undo this. The people want Absalom. They do not want God's choice. God's choice ultimately would be Solomon. But here they are trying, and God says, no, God's choice will stand. Solomon will be on the throne, not Absalom. Now, regarding the character of David and the character of the people, we see that David's repentance is steadfast tonight. And we see a broken, humble man willing to submit to whatever the Lord has for him. As for the people, we see they haven't changed in roughly 80 years since the time of Samuel. Absalom is fundamentally Saul 2.0. The Lord said to Samuel, listen to the voice of the people in regard to all that they say to you, for they have not rejected you, but they have rejected me from being king over them. They didn't like God's choice for leadership. They didn't like Samuel. They rejected him. And they're doing fundamentally the same thing here in rejecting David, God's choice. You know, this is revealing their character. He's disciplining David, but at the same time, he's revealing the hearts of men. Ultimately, things like this, as Paul points out, for there must be factions among you so that those who approve may become evident. On the one hand, we see the vast majority of people following Absalom, rebelling against the Lord. And yet we see that tiny remnant that is following David and sticking with him. Unexpected people, people he never dreamed would be doing this. Stay with him. The first three are the principled, Ittai, Zadok, and Hushai the... Ittai, Zadok, and Hushai the Archite. Kind of interesting there. He's very possibly a Canaanite. It's kind of iffy. You know, the Archites are, it's their origin is a little sketchy in the Old Testament there. It's hard to determine. Then again, we see the problematic, and we see Ahithophel down there. This is the person who is decidedly against David. Any questions before we get into the text here tonight? Okay, who? Yes, Andrew.
Would it list, now that I have a better understanding of the size of the city of David at the time, mm-hmm. It's interesting that if David had not heard about what Absalom was doing as far as ministering to the people, quote unquote, that if he had known about it, but in the context that small, it would be kind of surprising if he didn't know that. I mean, because that's a relatively small area.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would agree. Anyone else? Okay, who would like to read verses 30 and 31? Yes, Anita. Okay, thank you. David went up the ascent of the Mount of Olives. This is what we're talking about here. This is the Mount of Olives. Kind of here's the city of David. So we're talking north and east of the city of David. Again, this portion is not occupied at this point. He's traveling this direction. Absalom's coming from the south, southwest, into the city, and David is fleeing to the northeast. And it says, and he wept as he went, and his head was covered, and he walked barefoot. Not very conducive to a quick getaway here. It makes you say, are you really serious about getting away here? He is. He wants everybody to escape. But what is this all about? Why the bare feet and weeping and so forth? Okay, why? Okay, so that's the immediate crisis, right? Anything else? Okay, rejection by the people, that certainly could factor in there. Yeah, I think that definitely is looming large in his mind. Certainly those factors in, I mean, there's a lot going on in his mind, but he is realizing this is his fault. He knows why God is allowing this, why he's doing this. He knows it ultimately falls to him. All the people join David in this state of mourning. They are broken as well. Perhaps, you know, not exactly the same motives in this, but they are fleeing from their homes and they join with David.
Jason,
yes.
When the king cries, everybody
cries. That's right. Excuse me. And then we have the mention of Ahithophel. And this becomes a significant figure in the story here. We've already read of his defection, that Absalom has called for him. He lived just south of Hebron. So he is with Absalom as they're making their way into Jerusalem, this grand procession of presenting him as king. And when we look at what the Bible says about Ahithophel, these psalms were written, Psalm 51, Psalm 41. These psalms, these references, I believe, do refer to Ahithophel, and we'll talk about why in a moment. But let's just read them together. For it is not an enemy who reproaches me, then I could bear it. Nor is it one who hates me, who has exalted himself against me. Then I could hide myself from him. But it is you, a man, my equal, my companion, and my familiar friend. He who had sweet fellowship together, we who had sweet fellowship together, walked in the house of God in the throng. So here we see a very intimate friend, the person that he never really thought would do this to him. It's definitely not referring to Absalom. I think, you know, he knew there were problems there. He wanted to think the best. But then you look at Psalm 41, same kind of description concerning a person. All who hate me whisper together against me. Against me they devise my hurt, saying, a wicked thing is poured out upon him, that when he lies down, he will not rise up again. Even my close friend in whom I trusted, who ate my bread, has lifted up his heel against me. Now, what reasons might we have to conclude that this is Ahithophel? It's not like David had a little answer key at the bottom and said, oh yeah, this is about Ahithophel. What would cause us to think that this is Ahithophel? Well, number one, he was David's most trusted advisor. So let's just start there. We read this twice in the scriptures, and Absalom sent for Ahithophel, the Gilonite, David's counselor. That's further elaborated in the next chapter. The advice of Ahithophel, which he gave in those days, was as if one inquired of the word of God. So was all the advice of Ahithophel regarded by both David and Absalom. So he was a valued counselor here. He was his right-hand man. He was the guy that he trusted his advice on a level that, you know, perhaps is a little too high, but it just makes the point. It makes the point that he confided and needed this man deeply. They had a close relationship. Number two, I would say, reasons for identifying this nameless individual in the Psalms as Ahithophel, is that here we see 200 residents coming with David. I'm sorry, with Absalom to the city of David. 200 men that were, you know, close to David, served in his capital city. Countless others are following from Hebron. I'm sure they're gathering people as they go through the countryside. Quite a host coming up to the city. Yet only one person is significant enough for someone to bring a report to David. This is the only report we hear out of all those people. Ahithophel is the only one that is reported to David as being among the defectors. And third, the third reason to conclude that this is Ahithophel is the parallel of these psalms and their application to Judas. Okay, let me develop this for you and it'll make sense. We read Psalm 41:9, even my close friend in whom I trusted, who ate my bread, has lifted up his heel against me. We see in Matthew, Luke, he answered, he who dipped his hand with me in the bowl is the one who will betray me. But behold, the hand of the one betraying me is with mine on the table. That emphasis of eating with him, sharing a meal, a mark of friendship. And then, of course, we have the clincher, John 13:18. I do not speak of all of you. I know the one I have chosen. But it is that the scripture may be fulfilled. He who eats my bread has lifted up his heel against me. So Jesus cites this verse and associates it with Judas. Say, okay, well, it's clearly associated with Judas. What does this have to do with Ahithophel? Well, let's read one more passage here. Matthew 26. While he was still speaking, behold, Judas, one of the 12, came up accompanied by a large crowd with swords and clubs, who came from the chief priests and elders of the people. Now he who was betraying him gave him a sign, saying, whomever I kiss, he is the one. Seize him.
Immediately, Judas went up to Jesus and said, "Hail, Rabbi," and kissed him. And Jesus said to him, "Friend, do what you have come for." Then they came and laid hands on Jesus and seized him. So this is the critical moment. This is the actual betrayal transpiring. Where was it? It was on the Mount of Olives, wasn't it? Where did David get word of Ahithophel's defection? On the Mount of Olives. So it's pretty strong that this is a reference to Ahithophel, as far as the Psalms. In David's day, it was Ahithophel. Of course, it was also a prophecy in reference to Judas as well. But for me, in my mind, the parallels to Judas are the clincher here as far as it being Ahithophel who is in view there. Okay, well, what was reported? Any questions or thoughts before we move on in the passage here? Okay, well, Ahithophel, it says, "Now someone told David, saying, Ahithophel is among the conspirators with Absalom. And David said, O Lord, I pray, make the counsel of Ahithophel foolishness." Now, the initial reading of this, it's not abundantly clear, but this is the turning point in the text. Okay, this is the turning point in the story. Things actually get worse before they get better. But when you look at the whole thing, this is the critical moment. This is the turning point where things turn around for David. You know, Absalom is, everything's been moving in his direction, and it's going to move in his direction even more superficially. But ultimately, God has now launched his own conspiracy against Absalom. He conspires against the conspirator. And he deceives the conspirator just as he has deceived his father. Now, as we think about when Ahithophel is brought to his attention, what is his greatest concern regarding Ahithophel? Okay. Yeah, this guy is not, he's not a mighty general. Okay, he's not going to go into battle against David, and he's going to have to face him, and it's going to be a David and Goliath type of situation. He's afraid of what's going on between his ears. He's afraid of what's going to come out of his mouth and what he's going to tell Absalom and what Absalom's going to be empowered to do because of this man. All right, he's already David's intimate friend. He already knows David inside out. He knows him frontwards, backwards. They had sweet fellowship together. I'm sure they sat down at the table and planned, you know, campaigns and so forth. He knows this guy. Ahithophel knows David. And so not only does he have that intimate knowledge of him, but he is an exceedingly wise man. And so he can now turn that knowledge around and use it against David. And he's terrified by this reality. Excuse me. In his estimation, he cries out to God because only God is wiser than Ahithophel in his opinion. God is the only one who could stop this guy at this point. With his intimate knowledge and his skills, God is the only one who could overcome him. Now, a few observations regarding this prayer which God answers. The first one is regarding David's attitude at this moment. He has just said this to Zadok, "Return the ark of God to the city. If I find favor in the sight of the Lord, then he will bring me back again and show me both it and its habitation. But if he should say thus, I have no delight in you, behold, here I am, let him do to me as seems good." So that indicates what kind of attitude? Submission, the will of the Lord be done, it's in his hands. And yet, you know, he's resigned to whatever the Lord decides. Is when he prays to the Lord now, is it a prayer of faith? Okay, it's a prayer of faith. Even though he's like, well, whatever will be. God will choose. I guess what I'm getting at is the attitude behind it. I'm being rhetorical here. Let me just make my point. In John 15:16, we read this. "You did not choose me, but I chose you and appointed you that you would go and bear fruit and that your fruit would remain, so that whatever you ask of God and of the Father in my name, he may give it to you." My point is that here's David asking for help, but he just said, well, God will answer however he wants to answer, or he'll do whatever he wants to do. Are those two realities compatible? Okay. Yes, they are. It's fully compatible. And in fact, it's exactly what is being conveyed in this verse. Because this right here, in my name, is actually setting a limitation on our request. It is letting God be God. In other words, you're saying, I pray this in the name of your son. Whatever is consistent with his name, then answer according to his name. Whatever is compatible with who Jesus is. It's a humbly submitting your request. So there is a whatever here, but that's not a blank check. Right here, in my name, qualifies it. And of course, John's a little clearer in his epistle. He says, this is the confidence which we have before him, that if we ask anything, he hears us. No, that's not what it says. If we ask anything according to his will, he hears us. That's what's being indicated by Jesus when he says, in my name. You know, if you ask anything, whatever you ask, It's open. There's kind of this openness to it, but then it's qualified. Has to be according to his name, which is synonymous with being according to his will. Okay. So that's my first observation I wanted to talk about. My second one is God answers this prayer immediately. According to verse 30, what was David's apparel on this occasion? What was it? No shoes. He had his head covered. So what's he doing as he has his head covered?
Praying.
He's praying with his head covered. Does that pose a problem for anybody? You know, it's interesting. We have this instance here where he's praying with his head covered. Oh, let me get here. And we go to 1 Corinthians 11, and he says, for a man ought not to have his head covered, in context, when he prays or prophesies, since he is the image and glory of God, but the woman is the glory of man. For man does not originate from woman, but woman from man. For indeed, man was not created for the woman's sake, but woman for the man's sake. What is interesting about this is he ties the practice of the man not praying with his head covered back to what? To creation. Is creation before or after David? Okay. Yes. Well before. So now we have an instance of a man who is, who is praying with his head covered. And of course, the Lord answers. Is this another instance of God's mercy and he's just, you know, overlooking this oversight by David? It is interesting when we look at Leviticus chapter 10, verse 6. You know, the high priest, this is after his sons die, he's told never to uncover his head in the performance of his duties. The high priest always wore a turban, and he's told never to uncover his head. So there's an instance where a man in his fulfilling his duties of representing, okay, the people to God, which certainly prayer was a part of this. I guess, well, I can't pray today. I'm fulfilling my duties. I will not pray to the Lord. He was not to uncover his head in the performance of his duties all day long. He was to have his head covered. Now, that's interesting because, again, we get here, you know, what could this possibly mean then? If this goes all the way back to creation, what could this possibly mean? Of course, I'm going somewhere with this. But what I see here is since Paul traces this all the way back to creation, we need to think in terms of all the way back in creation. When Eve was created, what covered her head? First of all, what were they? What's the word used to describe their apparel? Naked. They were naked. Okay. So whatever it was that God's referring to here and elsewhere, I mean, it's in the passage where the woman was to have her head covered. The man wasn't. The woman was. I see it as her hair, and specifically long hair. Because he discusses the different lengths and so forth. And by the end, he does even say her hair is given to her for a covering. And of course, the distinction with that discussion of lengths, I would see that as long hair is what's being indicated there. Any questions or thoughts?
I was going to make a comment about this. Because Caesar will say that the long hair, the man should have no hair. But you're making the difference between long hair and short hair.
which is not made there.
What's that?
They make over here. Is that correct?
Well, I would say that that's what Paul is referring to. Yeah.
You would say that's not what he says there.
Well, this is the challenge. Yeah. Is Paul uses an unusual way of describing this. A word that isn't used anywhere else in the New Testament. A word that arguably is a very odd way to refer to the length of the hair. But very clearly when he's discussing, you know, he talks about shearing it, very short, shaving it. And then in that context, I would look at that and say, okay, he's talking about a difference in length of hair. And he's referring to the woman having her head covered in the sense that she is growing it long and presenting herself distinctly as a woman.
Get into an argument, though, but there is more to the text, and there are different language in the text that would seem to indicate that there is something behind, besides hair. There are two things that are mentioned. So we are focusing on a particular aspect of the text, but there's more to the text than those two verses. So,
yeah, in my mind, the clincher is Eve. The clincher is Eve. She's naked. So if this goes all the way back to Adam and Eve and transcends even the Old Testament where the priest was not to uncover his head in the performance of his duties, you know. And my point is here's David with his head covered. It, you know, again, head covered with.
Yeah, but there is, you know, we have, and not together, we have different dispensations and we have different situations because David is not only praying but he's mourning. And the covering of the head goes more with the mourning.
Okay. Well, Paul takes it back to creation, and he doesn't make that distinction, you know. Okay. Who would like to read for us verses 32 through 37? Yes, Jeff.
Now it happened when David had come to the top of the mountain where he worshipped God, there was Hushai, the Archite, coming to meet him with his robe torn and dust on his head. David said to previously, so I will now also be your servant. Then you may defeat the council of Ahithophel for me. And do you not have Zadok and Abiathar the priests with you there? Therefore it will be that whatever you hear from the king's house, you shall tell to Zadok and Abiathar the priests. Indeed, they have there with them their two sons, Ahimaaz, Zadok's son, and Jonathan, Abiathar's son. And by them,
thank you. So as David was coming to the summit, it says, where God was worshipped. What is another name for this descriptor here? The summit where God was worshipped. Okay, it's the Mount of Olives, but these were actually kind of found all over the place. The summit where God was worshipped. Think of an Old Testament term that occurs again and again and again. No? A high place. Okay. This is a high place. And since the taking of the ark, since the worship of Israel had fallen into disarray, really, it wasn't until the building of Solomon's temple that we see Israel's worship consolidated again, it becoming conforming to the law. And becoming regular. Here it's still irregular. In fact, this irregularity persisted until the Babylonian captivity. These high places were continually used in this way to worship God. And of course, they eventually were used to worship other gods. And that was the danger in there. And that's why they weren't to worship God at these places. And so they were contrary to the law. It happened as David was coming to the summit where God was worshipped that behold, Hushai the Archite met him. What is the author doing with the words that behold? Why does he interject those words? That behold. Okay, this is a significant event. Why is it significant? In context. What have we just read about? Well, maybe by some. David has just what? He's just prayed that the Lord would thwart the counsel of Ahithophel. And now he says, behold, Hushai arrives. That's introducing Hushai as the answer to his prayer. And we do see that this ultimately is the individual that God uses to thwart the good counsel of Ahithophel. He's indicating that this individual is the answer to that prayer. God has answered. And now that David sees this answer, he gets excited. And it's let go and let God time, right? What does he do? Yeah, he launches a plan. He's like, wow, this is great. Now, isn't that interesting? He prays to God for God to intervene, and yet once he sees that intervention, it's not like, oh, whew, it's all over. It's we're good now. God's taking care of this, and I don't have to do anything more. No, it's just the opposite. He says, ah, now I have to formulate a plan. Now I have to do this. The plan, the first element of the plan is what? And? Okay, which would require?
He has to pledge allegiance.
Yeah, he has to lie to him, right? He has to lie to him. And we've talked about this in the past. He tells him, he says, return to the city and say to Absalom, I will be your servant, O king, as I have been your father's servant in the time past, so I will now be your servant. So go back and lie to him, okay? Well, I don't have time to get in that one again, but we've talked about lying in the past, and here it is. This is part of it. The deception is part of this plan, and we could debate whether or not God blesses this kind of thing. Certainly he did in this instance. The second element was to thwart the good counsel of Ahithophel. Okay, it's going to be good. You're going to have to be shrewd here. Okay, because he can't just come out and be blatantly antagonistic to Ahithophel. He'll show his true colors. Okay, he's got to subtly introduce this and subtly try to undermine Ahithophel, which he succeeds at. And then the third element is to send a message through the sons of the priests. What is very interesting here is that it almost seems that his intentions in Hushai were his initial intentions in the priests. Because he said, are you not a seer? In other words, are you not a person that Absalom would consult? Go back to the city, seems to be what he's saying to them. But when he sees Hushai, he now sees somebody who can really do this. Okay, and he's going to work in conjunction with these now, in tandem with them. They're going to be the messengers, but he's going to fulfill that role of advisor that he was hoping they would fulfill earlier. Isn't it amazing how when he prayed this prayer, he probably more than likely was praying it in conjunction with those priests in mind. Lord, thwart the good counsel of Ahithophel. I've sent these guys back. They're seers. Ahithophel will talk to them. And yet God had a different answer in mind. And moments later he finds out, ah, Hushai. And once he sees him, yes, this is way better than my plan, way better than my initial plan. This guy can get it done. Okay, well, he says, so Hushai, David's friend, came into the city, and Absalom came into Jerusalem. This is really interesting how the author puts this together. He has them coming in together, which they did, but the way he states this, it shows that just as Absalom felt that he had gained his purpose, simultaneously, as he's triumphantly entering into the city from the southwest corner, Hushai's coming in from the northeast corner. They're both entering the city at the same time. Just as he thought he was gaining his purpose, the seeds of demise had been sown in the city as well. And he was now going, it was going to crumble. We've seen that Ittai, Zadok, Hushai, these are the three key loyalists who helped to bring Absalom down. And so those, everything's been sown, the seeds are growing, and Absalom will ultimately be destroyed. I mentioned this last time, I thought it bore repeating here again. For there must be factions among you, so that those who are approved may become evident among you. We see those who are disapproved, Ahithophel. We see those who are approved, Ittai, Zadok, Hushai, people you thought would never stay, that's Ittai. And people you thought would never leave, leave. That's Ahithophel. That's what we see here. I also see God is sovereign. He has orchestrated the demise. Well, first he orchestrated the discipline of David. And then now, having accomplished that purpose, he is now orchestrating the demise of Absalom. Even before David called upon him. Even before David, those pieces were starting to fall into place. Even before David called on him in this instance. And yet, he chose to work in conjunction with David's prayer. The final piece of the puzzle came into conjunction with David's prayer. Okay? And even then, he launched into a plan. Now, why does God do this? Well, in part, because he wants us to be dependent upon him. He wants us to call upon him. I mean, he's doing it. But yet he works through our prayer. He works in response to this reality in David's life. He calls on him. He answers. And of course, he had learned this lesson many years earlier in his life. This is Psalm 34, a psalm of David when he feigned madness before Abimelech, who drove him away and he departed. Verse 6, this poor man cried and the Lord heard him and saved him out of all his troubles. Now, what's interesting is David at this point in his life, is he poor? Does he have nothing? Is he destitute? Yeah, he's at the top of his game. He has everything, right? But isn't it amazing how the Lord can bring you back down and you're like, Lord, it's all up to you. That's exactly what he does here. He's right back. I mean, this was probably one of the lowest points of his life right here. Now he's at the highest point of his life. But the same reality is still holding true. You have to call upon the name of the Lord and he will save you. This poor man cried and the Lord heard him and saved him out of all of his troubles. We see that exact reality being played out in his life here with Absalom as well. So we're never above this. We never get beyond this. We never get to the point where you sit there and say, oh, well, you know, God's obviously for me. Nope. He'll make you see that you need him all the time. Okay, well, Dwight's going to take prayer requests because I'm going to go see if I can catch part of the derby here tonight.